You are listening to the For the Rose Tech Podcast, episode 297, Makers, Internet Trends, and the Reality of AI. Welcome to season 7, episode 297 of the For the Rose Tech Podcast. Today is June the 4th, 2017. I'm Matthew Dean Furlow, and wondering about the wonderful wonder that was Wonder Woman is my brother James Furlow.
Woo. That was a statement there. Yeah, I did not get to go see it because we're poor planners. But I hear it's pretty good and it's on my list for sure. We gotta find a babysitter because Jessie wants to see it, and I don't blame her. It's one of her faves. So, I'm going to. Did you see it?
I did see it.
I
think I mentioned this last
thumbs
week.
Thumbs up, thumbs down.
My girlfriend's has the same name as the titular character, so
her first name is Wonder?
Yes.
Amazing.
So it is similarly my girlfriend's favorite character. I don't know why I'm not using her name, since if you know Wonder Woman at all, you know. But it's besides the point.
First name is Princess?
Exactly. it's good. It's really good. It's getting like a...
I heard it was less serious than, say, Superman or Superman v. Batman, but also, you know, not campy either. Like, it almost Marvel-esque.
Yeah. Yeah, they take death and dying pretty seriously. Like, there's a lot of cost of war. It's not...
As you should.
Yeah, it's not... It wasn't like, what's it called? The movie with the bad
Captain
guys.
Captain America?
No. Suicide Squad. Which is all, you know, like, just everybody was dying all the time, and they were basically zombies, so there was very little, like, cost to the people that were being killed and doing the killing. And, you know, which is good. It's good when they do that, but at the same time, it wasn't, like, dark and brooding. One of the things that I've heard, like, fans of the genre complain about Zack Snyder's movie so far is just this, like, real, like, it's not just that it's dark. It's that it's pessimistic. Whereas people were like, you know, the whole idea of Superman is that there's supposed to be this hopefulness. It's supposed to be borderline on campy because he's such a freaking optimistic guy and he's capable of so much and he can make the world a better place and that's his goal. Whereas the Zack Snyder ones, the two most recent one, he's kind of like, yeah, he's just kind of sad and mopey because people aren't nice. And
I heard the best description of it was like, it's almost like Zack Snyder doesn't like Superman.
Yeah, exactly. And, or is that one, that's not the case at all with this one. They do a much better job of making her an optimistic and,
Is it a different director?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The story...
Well, hopefully that means Zack's out of a job.
No, yeah. We'll see what happens with Justice League.
Is he doing that one?
Yes.
Oh, mm.
Actually, so it's interesting. This is sad, but he wrote and directed Justice League. They're through principal production. They're into post production. They're going to have to do some reshoots and stuff. And just last week, he announced that he was stepping away from the project because his daughter committed suicide, and he wanted to spend more time with his family. What's his name? Avengers guy. Guy who made Avengers. Firefly.
Josh Whedon?
Yeah, Josh Whedon. Josh Whedon has taken over.
What?
For Justice League. And he said...
Yes!
He said that it is his job. He wants to maintain the tone and everything that Zach was going for. He's just... The ship has got a lot of momentum. They're not trying to change anything. He's just maintaining the ship's speed. But it'll be pretty hard for Joss Whedon not to be all Joss Whedon-y when making it. He's got a...
Well, he'll get all that say over the editing and stuff.
Yes.
That'll make a difference.
Make a huge difference. And he'll probably make one of the characters make a Joss Whedon-esque quip. And... So how can you not? but
kill somebody unexpectedly, like Superman. Oh,
wait. only to have them not actually be dead. Oh, wait. Zack Snyder playing the Joss Whedon.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah.
But normally it's a side character.
I know. Yeah.
A lovable, affectionate side character.
Yes. It's just terrible.
To him and then tear him away from you.
But yeah, it's good. I definitely would go see it. Also in pop culture news, Warriors are 2-0, baby. Oh, baby. So excited.
After last year where they were up 3-1.
You know what? I don't want to talk about it.
It's hard
The past is the past. You know, you don't think about it.
Forget
about it.
I was talking with someone about the Warriors and they were like, man, they killed the Cavs. Now, actually, it was a smaller margin this year than it was last year in game one. So I wouldn't quite say they killed the Cavs because they beat them by 24 points last year.
I know.
I'm just trying to Snyder you. That's all.
I know.
Keep it real.
It's just brutal. The coolest part about it is that, I really like the Warriors. A cool part about it that actually has something to do with this show is the fact that I've got the Apple TV set up. Now it's like, I was living in the place I was living. We had cable because my roommates wanted cable. And so I watched the games over cable, but I don't have cable now. So
how do you do it?
I've got the Apple TV going and doing the ESPN app. And you're going to ask, how are you watching the shows on ESPN without cable? Well, still have the login credentials, but it's really nice to be doing the cable cutter sort of deal and be like, yeah, we're plugged into fiber and we're just using the ESPN app. I think I'm going to look into the PlayStation View app. It's gotten really good reviews and they had an ad going that was saying you could actually watch basketball games on it. I was like, well, hey, now that's alluring.
So let's see. I know the games are on ABC, but
right now,
and ABC are both owned by Disney.
Yeah.
Is that where you can watch it?
I don't know.
I just would have expected you to be doing it over the air.
ABC
app.
I guess because it's the ABC broadcast that is being piped through ESPN, so... I guess. I don't really know.
Joys of owning both networks, I suppose.
I know. I don't hate it. I'm a fan. But it's good stuff, man.
Disney's okay with the two since they're losing subscribers left and right.
Yeah, exactly.
So do what you can.
Yeah. Please watch
us. Dude, the death of cable TV.
Dude, that's the industry that, you know, it's funny. We had we talked earlier this week about disruptions and how what's really amazing is when an industry is being disrupted, you there's a long period where you're being disrupted before the former players in the market realize it. And by the time they realize it, it's way too late. And there have been some shocking viewership numbers out in this last quarter. And the ratings are just plummeting all over the place. It's pretty amazing that it is a market in the middle of being disrupted and nobody knows what to do other than to buckle up and hope it turns out okay. Thankfully, Disney's got the Marvel and Star Wars universes to buoy them through the hard times.
Yeah, right.
Anyways, that's not what we're here to talk about, James. This week,
what are we here to talk about?
Like every week, I'm glad you asked. We'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera, and by that we mean the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James got a short disclosure he wants to throw our way.
I found it and work for HPI, but do not represent HP or any of their opinions. I will not be discussing the court case that was unfavorable to them because it really doesn't matter. I also own part of Twitter, Etsy, and Lending Club.
All right. I like it.
It's technically Lexmark, about ink sales, but... All right, just real quick. Lexmark lost this court case, Supreme Court, saying that they could not legally stop refillers from refilling ink.
Bummer.
Which...
I mean, unless you're a customer.
Well, no, that's the point, is they were trying to tell customers you're not allowed to resell them.
Well, what I said is, a bummer, unless you're a customer.
And then, oh, I understand. Gotcha. Yeah, but it's one of those where Lexmark and HP and others haven't been able to stop it for years, so it doesn't really matter. They just legally now have no footing, but it's not like all of a sudden refillers are going to flood the market. Like, all these articles were like, oh man, look out now. Like, no, it's not look out.
Well, the real issue
been the same is that the cat and mouse game will continue.
Well, the real issue is that nobody prints anymore. That's not true. You keep telling me that, James. You keep telling me that. one of us is becoming more right with every passing week.
Printing still happens. That's important.
That's Yeah, so if you want to follow the show at the week, you can do that. My Twitter is at Matthew D. Furlow. My Instagram is nextwiggin4 at... No, just the nextwiggin4.
Just at Instagram. James Furlow. Everywhere. Twitter mostly. Facebook. I've been inviting people to be my Facebook friends.
Oh, yeah? Again. After last week's conversation?
I was like, you know what? I need to quit being so stingy. It's meaningless anyways, so let me just start adding people.
Isn't it all kind of meaningless in the end? These are earthly activities.
I'm not that wise. I can't
say. If you want to get more information about the TV, or about the TV show, the podcast, you're more than welcome to do that. Everything that we talk about today is inspired by a link. This is a deductive podcast, where we start with an article and we use that as a leaping point to talk about whatever topic we're going to talk about. Well, if you want one of those articles, you can go to don't go to Facebook. Go to furlowbros.com. You can go to Facebook too, but you're going to have to follow the link to furlowbros.com. It's pretty easy to spell. Everything that we talk about will be there. Clicks, links, videos, audio clips, whatever. Also, all the information for the podcast, the YouTube video. Just check it out. Have a good time. We do it for you. It's pretty nice.
My first?
Sorry. Yes, sir.
All right. So this is just awesome. So Pokemon Go, I'm sure you've heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a game where you go around finding Pokemon. It's an AR, artificial reality, augmented reality game. And the idea is to go catch them all. You have to physically go to a place. Your phone will tell you where they are. Point your phone in that direction and then throw Pokeballs at them and catch them. Well, as you could imagine, that's laborious work.
Yes.
You have to get off the couch, go find a Pokemon, go throw some balls at it.
That's hard.
So, some ingenious peoples have come up with different apps to simulate you walking around so that you can just tell it where to go and it will, spoof your GPS to make it seem like you were actually there, and then you can go catch your Pokemon, get some really cool stuff. Well, surprise. Oh. Well, all right. Wired is not going to let me read this article on my computer. It's cool. I don't have an ad blocker on my computer or on my iPad. I will switch devices. Anyways, there is a there's different things you can do and that to try to dissuade third party things like this working. One of the options, because it's against their terms of service,
No.
You actually got to walk around and where in the world did I put it? You actually got to walk around and try to do this for reals, guys. Quit messing with us. And so you could just ban people who are, improperly using it. That's an option.
Yeah.
See, this is why I have ad blockers. You guys are so annoying. it just hits me with boom, boom, boom. Sign up. Niantic, the creators of Pokemon Go, they had a different idea. And this is just awesome. Because they were able to tell who's kind of cheating somehow, you know, who really knows how, but they were able to figure it out. So instead of just banning them, which they had done that before, they're doing something new. Now, if they detect that you're using one of those, you just get the beginning level Pokemon.
Yeah.
And that's it. You somehow can't find the awesome ones anymore.
That's really funny.
Which is awesome. So, like, yeah, play to your heart's content. But, you know, because, you know, part of it is, if you're not running around and not doing all this stuff, it's super easy to level up. You're not going to pay, blah, blah, blah. You know, so they have an incentive for you to play the game right, because if you do it right, you can't level up fast enough, I guess.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, it's just a bunch of the, like, Squirtles and those little Bat-Goo dudes and just a bunch of the beginning ones. I just think that's awesome.
That is really funny.
What a way to... I thought the headline on Wired was the best. Instead of banning cheaters, Pokemon Go trolls them hard.
That's really funny. speaking of...
That's a great idea.
Speaking
of games, should do that. We'll let you keep playing. We're just gonna suck all the fun out of it.
There's actually a game where they had to deal with this, and it's really interesting because the game is it's a simulator where you're a game developer. So it's kind of like SimCity, but you start with some money, you got to develop a game, you build a platform, you turn that into profits, you sell the game, you do more development, and it's just a simulator, but for game development. And one of the things that you struggle with in the game is piracy. How to deal with piracy. Well, if you pirate the game and you break their piracy protection stuff, they added code in to make it so that the piracy during the gameplay would become so aggressive, there'd be no way for you to make enough profit to keep playing. It would just... ruin your if you pirated the game where you pretended to be a game developer, it would ruin your game developer company that you were simulating. It's just pretty funny. I'm a big fan of those sorts of, like, yeah, just don't just outright block them, but yeah, mess with them. It's teach them a lesson. And especially with Pokemon Go, because it's such a giant community, and they reach a lot of people who don't traditionally play video games. So you got a lot of people who their first time that they've ever played a video game, and they read online about how to cheat, and they might go in and cheat without really realizing what they're doing. So to ban them is can be harsh, I think, because it's going to discourage a lot of introductory players who you're trying to bring into a bigger market of Pokemon. And so I think it's a really good strategy for them to instead of punish you by never letting you play again, to punish you by just making it not as much fun. And you're way less likely to drive potential customers away as opposed to encouraging them to play fair. And unlike a lot of your esports games where there's huge amounts of money and a really, really high bar of don't cheat, where you do want to ban anybody who's cheating as quickly as possible to keep the competitive nature of the game fair. But that's like a sports game. Right. It's not the same. Yeah, I like it. It's good. Good job, Pokemon. Y'all know what's up. Cool.
Yeah, I just like it. I can appreciate it. I would love to sit in those types of meetings, you know, and just where they were like, I got an idea.
Yeah,
you know, there's certain people who I work with where I feel like, you know, they're mean enough where they would come up with these kind of ideas, and it's nice to see, like, it somehow made it high enough
of a position
that they were like, let's do this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a...
You know, like, I'm trying to think, like, what would the equivalent be for, like, printing? Like, yeah, you know what? Third-party cartridge, we'll let you print, no big deal. Oh. Full bleed color the entire time? Sweet, yeah, we're in.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll use composite black, no problem.
Exactly. That's really funny.
Sandy, that would get us in trouble.
Probably. Yeah. I think the Supreme Court just explicitly stated that it would get you in trouble.
No. The Supreme Court said we can't dictate how you use our products because they're sold. We could still mess with you on the printer end. I feel like we would get sued yet again.
Yeah, probably. But,
wow, this third-party ink just does not last, does it? Weird.
I don't know why.
Well, you know, we're just not sure of the quality, so we print everything twice right on top.
Right, yeah, exactly.
We want to ensure it's good quality.
Yeah.
Oh, fun stuff. Fun stuff.
That's really funny. So, yeah, I like it. You know, it gets funny. I guess it's sort of like when Apple would, you know, if you use an uncertified third-party charger, and it tells you, this won't charge your phone, sorry. You know, under the premise of it's unsafe. But that device is using the USB protocol. Like, you're not using this additional protocol. Yeah, you know what? That is weird. It's a weird one. It's all about how you frame it, man. It's all about how you frame it. Apple's doing it for the customer's protection, to protect a very expensive device. So, or that's their justification for why you have to go and buy a device that they'll get paid for. That's interesting. Huh. Speaking of Apple devices, James, tomorrow is the opening day of the world. Apple's worldwide.
You're listening to this.
That's a good point. Yeah. Is the opening of the Worldwide Developer Conference. Since most of you will probably be listening to this podcast after they've announced everything, it's probably not much of a point to make a lot of big predictions. So I think at this point it's just worth talking about, like, what not necessarily what they're going to talk about, but the fact that nobody really knows what they're going to talk about, which is really kind of interesting. I've read a bunch of these, like, here's what to expect from WWDC, and they're all going with the there's going to be a competitive product to Amazon's Alexa / Google Home, some sort of in-home speaker. Nobody really knows what that looks like, other than they think that they're also going to try to compete against Sonos. But like I just said, you will know what that looks like by the time you're listening to me talk about it. So I think what's even more fascinating is that at this point, this is the Worldwide Developer Conference. It's a conference geared towards developers, software developers. Nobody has any idea what new software is coming out. We know that they increment the iOS, their different operating systems, every year at this point. So we can expect there'll be an iOS 11, there'll probably be a Mac OS, number we're at for that, tvOS as well, watchOS.
Like 12 or something.
But nobody knows what's going to be in those operating systems. Nobody knows what new features they're trying to roll out. But the only thing that people are guessing kind of universally is that they're going to turn off 32-bit apps with this next operating system.
Yeah, because I've been getting warnings for a few of my apps saying, this game's not going to work in the next version of iOS.
Yeah.
Like, I have an app, Go, that I downloaded.
Yeah.
You know, because when AlphaGo was doing its thing, I was like, oh, how do you play this game? And so I downloaded it, figured out how to play it so I could understand what they were talking about. It's a pretty fun game. And and I opened it up recently. I don't know why, but I was just like, man, what the heck? I'm going to play another round. And it was like, hey, FYI, this is not going to work in the next version of iOS, just so you know.
Yeah,
I believe it.
My favorite.
But I didn't know it was the 32-bit, 64-bit thing. Bing.
Yeah.
64-bit thing.
My favorite calculator is going to be not going to work in the next operating system, which makes me real sad because it's my favorite calculator. I've been trying out new calculators, hoping to find one that is as good. And there aren't. So that's about the only thing we know, which, you know, isn't really much for developers. I mean, I've been predicting for months now that they're gonna announce APIs for their depth sensing camera that's already built into the iPhone 7. but they're going to take their private APIs and make them public. But nobody's even predicting that. There's nothing. And it's interesting because people have been talking about how Tim Cook really wanted, he made a statement that they were going to double down on secrecy. And
yeah,
I think that he might have succeeded because we've got one piece of hardware that we're like is a new piece of hardware that everybody's pretty sure is coming out, but nobody has any idea what it looks like. You've got talk of maybe like a refresh to some of the computers, to some of the like the MacBooks, but no real conversation about what that's going to look like. I don't know. It's amazing how we are on the eve of the WWDC and nobody knows nothing. And the other interesting part is that it seems like somebody is releasing fake iPhone 8 models at this point.
Really?
Yeah, because there's been two or three in different designs, and it's been pretty universally decided from people who have really good insider sources at Apple that the rear-mounted fingerprint scanner isn't going to be... There's not going to be a rear fingerprint scanner. And a lot of the leaks still have the rear fingerprint scanner being shown on the bodies. And there's theories that it's actually Samsung trying to seed the market with no, this is legit. Apple's doing this. We're the way we're doing it is the way that everybody wants to do it. But it could be Apple trying to head fake people. I don't know. It's interesting. Interesting stuff watching this company try to clamp down on and return back to where they were years ago, where there might be like scant rumors of what was going to come, but not just a we know everything predictions, which is what it's been like the last couple of years.
I know, which is great. It's great because it's been kind of boring to be like, oh yeah, well, we already know.
Yeah, it'll make next week big deal. Real fun, actually, which would be cool. So,
I'm excited. Are you going to watch it live or?
I don't know.
Are they live streaming it? I don't know.
Yeah, they always live stream it.
Well, they don't always. But
they've live streamed it for like the last like 6 years. I mean,
All right.
The only thing that would be kind of nice would be downloading the podcast on my phone over my current internet, just because it'd be so much fun to download a giant file really, really fast. But it would require me to wait and see what they announce. So I probably will watch it, though. At this point, it's the only keynote that I actually watched the whole thing on. And I'm trying not to be disappointed by Apple.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll watch it. I attempted to block out my calendar. We'll see how well that works.
Nice.
I seem to be hit or miss recently. But
I got actual work I have to do tomorrow morning, so.
Oh, man.
I know, I hate that.
That is nice. All right, well, we're going to see. A lot more to come on that next week.
Yeah.
All right. Here's the big deal. Mary Meeker came out with her internet trends report this last week. She does it at the Recode conference pretty much every year now. I have issues with her,
okay,
by the way. It's like it's gone. Where'd it go?
You're having a hard time today, man.
I am. Why is my view all? Oh, here we go. Weird. It's like 380 some odd slides.
Yeah. It's not quite curated enough for my preference.
Yes. It's like she can't determine what's important about the internet and just focus. I would prefer, and if you actually watch her do her thing, she's like, and then this, and then this, and then this, and then this, and then this. She does like all 300, that's almost 400 slides in like a half an hour.
Ridiculous.
It's stupid fast. And it's to the point where you're just like, I honestly would prefer you have 10.
Yeah.
You know, or what? Give me 30. You know, spend a minute on each one. Show me, like, okay, we've distilled it down to what we think is the important thing about the internet. And some of these things you're like, that could have been one slide, and you stretch it out over three. I really feel like you need to work on your density. It is my density. Anyways, gotta get that Back to the Future somehow. I'll be honest, I didn't read the whole thing because I was just annoyed by how long it was. But thankfully, TechCrunch did. They distilled it down to 56 slides. So.
Thanks, TC.
You know, and I'm kind of like, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you. And even then, there's a couple of them where I'm like, you guys kind of could have been 40.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just annoying. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, clearly it's become a thing, and it's become a reference document. Maybe that's the way to say it. And she just needs to be like, here's the whole thing, but I'm going to focus on, like, again, 30.
Right.
Here are the big trends that we see. But anywho's a what's it. Let's see here. Smartphone growth is slowing, by the way. And this is one where they spent three slides to say the same thing, where it was at like 10% year over year. It's now down to 3% year over year. Global internet users, though, continues to grow at 10% each year. So we still got people joining, but for the most part, people who have a cell phone, who want a cell... Oh my gosh, this is going to drive me nuts. How do I...
What was that noise?
It's me freaking hyperventilating. Because it decided... Oh man, all right, that's going to drive me nuts. Cell phones are saturated, but the internet's still growing. That's the takeaway there. Let's see here. I thought this was interesting. This was another, like, see, I did 1 point. That was four slides,
right?
By the way. And I felt like my 1 point was what you wanted to know.
Right.
the next one is that mobile ad dollars, they now exceed desktop, and they're about to eclipse TV ad spending. And if you compare how much time people spend in, like, print, radio, TV, internet, and mobile, it is currently advertising should, in theory, match that in terms of percentage of ad spend. Does that make sense? So where people spend 50% of their time, you want to spend 50% of your ad budget there. They are currently at parity for radio, TV, and internet. Good for us. They are over-indexed on print and under-indexed on mobile. So, not only is mobile now more than desktop, it is now the same as TV, it still has $16 billion worth of growth to go, assuming mobile attention doesn't take up more time than it currently is, which it's currently at 28% of our time. So all that to say, mobile ads will continue to be a thing.
Cool. That's not shocking, but I'm glad we got numbers to back it up.
Yeah. Also interesting about that, there's really only two people who provide mobile advertising companies. Do you know who they are?
I'm going to guess that it's Snapchat and Google and Facebook.
Yep. Pretty much. Also interesting... mobile ad blocking is huge in developing markets where data costs are high. So in the U.S., percentage of people who have mobile ad blocking, 1%. However, in China, 13%, India, 28%, and Indonesia, 58%.
Right. That's a lot. That's a lot more. That's significant.
Right? That's why I was like, holy cow. That's different. In contrast... They have it on desktop in the U.S. Looks like 18% of people block ads on the desktop. 28% in Germany, 24% in Canada. So those Indonesians, they hate their mobile ads, apparently.
I'll blame them.
I know, right? yeah, it's interesting that we're just at 1%, which I'm in that group, right? I have ad blocking on my desktop, but not on my mobile devices. Something about it just seems like it would be intrusive, and I just don't want to junk up my phone or something, or it's just not quite that bad. I don't know why.
I would say, yeah, I agree. It's not horrible, so I'm going to be okay with it. And
yeah. Well, there's something, I don't know, I feel like I want to keep it pure or something.
Yeah, it's the Apple thing of I don't want layers of programs on top of layers of programs, ideally, which is kind of a goofy way to look at it, I think, but that is the way that I look at it too.
Let's see here. Advertisers demand better targeting and measurement. This is true, actually. I was going back and forth with a guy. He does Facebook ads. That's like his job, I guess, or something. He's like a, you know, social media guy. I don't know. What do you call those people who they put together ads for other companies? And like he
was a
consulting company, I guess. No, it's an advertising company.
Right.
You just do online ads.
Okay.
And his job is to come up with the actual ads, figure out the target, spending, actually execute the idea. They've got a creative team, blah, blah, blah. Anyways, so I was talking with him because I was like, I'm going to be doing some marketing here in the next month or so, probably after the Tough Mudder. And I was like, I have a route to do physical mail because I can actually get their names and addresses. Kind of cool, right? And I was like, but I would love to be able to hit them online while I'm at it and actually kind of see how that goes, because it's going to be significantly less money to do it online. Excuse me, to do it online, because I got the list is free, but because it's all public information, and I'm willing to do my Excel wizardry to get it down to the point. So I got that going for me. But then you got to actually like make the postcard, write your message, print the postcard. You got to then mail the postcard, and you know, it's work. It's a couple bucks by the time you're all done, said and done. Whereas advertising, it's a couple pennies, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And I'm like, and I've got this list of 250, 500 people where I'm like, dude, I could spend some serious bones on these individual folks. And I want to see how it works because, you know, if they respond to me online, interesting. So anyway, so I was talking with him and was like, so if I have their name and address, can I go after them? Like,
yeah.
How do I do this? And interestingly, he was like, well, yes. He goes, what you can do is you actually have to break their fields up. You have to do first name, last name, and then I think it's their zip code, I think is what he was saying. And he goes, and then you put that into Facebook system, and they know who that person is because they'll be able to match first and last name, and they can match the IP with the zip code and go, yeah, we think this is the person that you're targeting. And so he's like, yeah, you can target your list of 250, assuming they're on Facebook. I was like, oh my gosh.
Right.
This is amazing. So I'm going to do that and figure out how it works. But advertisers are like, we want more of that, because one of the things I was learning about too is that IP targeting is the name of it, where if they know your address, then they know your IP, and then they can kind of track you and stuff.
Gotcha.
Like let's see here. Then they talk about what's driving purchase behavior. Like hyper-local ads are driving foot traffic, like the combination of Uber and Foursquare. I don't know. I don't get any of that. I mean, let me rephrase it. I don't get it because I don't do it, I guess, because
right.
I live in a suburban-ish area. By the way, every like four slides, I have an advertisement to buy the Galaxy S8 and get the new Gear 360 for $49.
I've
seen that ad quite a bit.
They're trying to get while the getting's good, James.
Dude, if I was a Galaxy user, I would totally buy it on that because I want a 360-degree camera.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Apparently this is interesting. User and influencer generated content make great advertising. So companies now are saying, this is an awesome picture. We would like to pay you to use your picture for the advertising. And instead of like having some sort of offline, like you take a great picture and you sell it to like a stock photo type of thing, and then the advertiser goes to stock photo, and that, you know what I mean?
Right.
Systems are learning. So like Instagram, like, oh dude, we could do this. Like you could be surfing Instagram and go, that's an awesome picture, I would want to use this for an ad.
Well,
button, and then boom.
I mean,
and then we've the talked, influencer picture taker gets paid.
Right, it's
brilliant.
We've talked about this. I mean, like those couples that they travel around the world all the time and they get paid for what they do, and you're like, how? What is that? Why do you get? But that's what that is. I mean, it's, you know, it's, well, part of what that is.
Yeah, but I mean, it's even more. No. It's like. So things like that, I think a lot of it was like product placement, right?
Okay.
Wear my shirt.
Gotcha.
I'll pay you to wear my shirt.
Gotcha. Whatever,
you know, 1,000 likes you get. This is more like you just so happened to take a picture of an ice cream cone.
Okay.
I'm an ice cream company. And I go, wow, that's a very well-taken photo. I would like to use that.
Gotcha.
They're talking about it in the future, I guess, because this isn't happening yet. Literally. They're going to be ads based on what you're looking at. I think that's... voice search. It's 20% of mobile searches are now made with voice.
Whoa.
That's more than I expected, but I also believe it because I know I do voice search stuff with relative frequency. Another Samsung ad. And then it says customer service is shifting to chat. And this is interesting. I heard, what was it? So, you know, there's all these pendulums that swing, right? Where at one point in time, customer service, like you actually talk to someone who was real. And then a bunch of companies figured out you can save a ton of money by having an automated machine that you talk to,
mm-hmm.
which the only people who like that are the accountants.
Yes, that's true.
Nobody else likes it. And so a lot of companies are recognizing that and saying, you know what, this is actually a distinguishing feature. We need to bring that back and it's worth investing in. But one of the ways they're trying to do it is to do real-time chat using, you know, Facebook Messenger or Intercom, apparently, is one.
Well, and the advantage of real-time chat is that you can manage more than one chat at a time. You don't have your customer service person locked up, and the script that they go by is, you know, it's perfectly typed out. So you can just have a bunch of hotkeys that they can just hit a button and continue the conversation, be managing a lot of different at different times. Yet you actually have a person there who can make the, you know, do the nuance of the nice part of having a person there.
Yeah. It's true.
Makes sense. It's
true.
Makes sense why people are doing it.
I saw these shoes that actually look pretty sweet. I think they're called Allbirds. They're an example of a lot of the direct to consumer brands, but they're providing less choice. Think of like Tom's Shoes, if you will,
right.
Or Warby Parker, where it's like you have less options, but the options you do have are pretty quality, and because they're going straight to consumers, they're actually a decent price, you know?
Right.
That's becoming a thing.
There's a watch company that was their whole thing, is they were like, they wanted to come out with really nice, they liked really nice watches, they wanted to buy really nice watches, but they were all super expensive. They did a bunch of research and found out, you know, if you just buy watches or get watches made for yourself and then sell directly to consumers, you can like half the price and still have the same profit margins. And so they just set up a website. And I wish I could remember the name of the watch company, because this would be a good time to plug them. But yeah, it's that same exact thing. It's a direct to consumers product brand. And yeah, and that's where that. But they're like supposed to be super high end watches, you know, or they're $1,000 watches you can get for $300-$400. Is what they're going for, which is, you know, if you're into watches, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Huh. Oh, this is interesting. Because of e-commerce shipping, like, shipping is becoming a thing again, where innovation is starting to be a focus because so many people like, you know, Amazon and whoever else they're doing it in such great volumes now that shipping companies are like, we need to figure out how to do this more effectively. So an example, like I think this was this week, Walmart is now doing some pilot where they pay employees to drop off packages on their way home.
Yeah.
And so that space is going to continue to heat up. And I think we saw Amazon got a patent for delivery slip that can turn into a parachute. And so there's going to be some interesting things happening in the delivery space. And you're getting a lot of the benefits right now just because you're in a populated place.
Yes.
I think places like me where, you know, that's where they want to, like, they want to go after rural America because I think there's a lot of growth there.
Right.
Let's see here. Food delivery is skyrocketing. Another Samsung ad. Oh, yeah. There's a slide that talks about Walmart competing. And they're saying brick and mortar is going to die unless you're Amazon, in which case it'll be fine. Gaming has gone mainstream, apparently. So in 1995, there were 100 million gamers, which that was a while ago. I'll admit it, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Now there's 2.6 billion quarterly video gamers, which is quite a lot. Games now earn $100 billion per year. That's up 9% year over year.
It's pretty good.
Crazy. And it's really, yeah. And it's gone from, like, I thought this was cool, where it had one player, arcade, two player, consoles. It had two plus players, which were like consoles and LANs. And it has a Nintendo 64 on there, which really confused me.
Yeah.
For representing consoles and LANs. But anyways. And then it went to millions of players, like an online network. And now it's millions of players plus spectators.
Right.
About, like, which is Twitch huge. And ESL and MLG and things like that. And yeah, so it's gone from, like, the solo living room, which has a picture of Pong, which I appreciate, to just arenas with thousands or online with millions of viewers. Pretty crazy. So it really has gone mainstream. Another Samsung ad. And then one of the things, and we've talked about this before, we're like, games are great at hitting that learning curve just right. And great games are great at hitting the learning curve.
Yes.
Right? That's one of the things we really appreciate about, like, what's his name? Miyamoto has talked about with Nintendo, where he's like, you know, when you start out with the very first Mario game, he's like, you're going and there's stairs up, a gap, and then stairs down, but there's for that gap, like, there's still ground there. So if you don't make it, no big deal. You didn't die. But then a little while later, stairs up, stairs down, exactly the same, except now if you fall down it, you die.
Right.
He's like, we do things like that. We train you, and then we add, and we layer, and we keep going. We focus on a skill, and then we add in the other stuff you've learned, and we just keep going, and so you have a good curve. One of the things that she's saying is that now they're gonna use a lot more machine learning to fine-tune these gaming mechanics.
Interesting.
And so it may... And we've talked, I feel like this has been something where it feels like it should have been a thing for years and it hasn't quite taken off. And they're like, it's going to be a thing now.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, we'll see. But just how, like, the way you play a game is going to be different than the way I play the game because the machine will recognize what level I'm at and play at my level.
Right.
And so, because they'll know, like, oh man, he barely died. Okay, we got to dial it back a little bit or something. Or better yet, it will... From having observed thousands, if not millions, of other players, when I pick it up, 30 seconds into the game, it's going to know what kind of player I am.
Right.
It's going to recognize the tendencies and the things and the play style that I have versus most likely somebody who's more advanced than
I think. I think what's really interesting, too, is the idea of, it's like most video games nowadays have different difficulty levels. You can make the game, you know, and they'll have three different, for example, have three different levels of easy, medium, and hard. And easy, they'll call it relaxed. How you make those differences is, like, let's say you're playing a shooter game. It's how durable you are, how much damage is done when somebody hits you, how powerful you are, how much damage when you hit somebody else, and how many extra, like, how many bullets are lying around for you to pick up. So how conservative you have to be with your resources.
Yeah.
So, like, the easiest version, there's tons of resources. You're a brick tank and you're firing a nuclear cannonball. When on hard, it's the opposite, where it's like, no, everybody else is a brick tank. There's barely enough bullets. And, you know, so if you don't make every bullet count, it's going to really, you know, you're not going to be able to win. Well, what's cool about the idea, and that's a very, it's a very coarse way of coming up with the difficulty levels. The idea of using AI for it is now you can fine tune it and say, you can have those same different difficulties. I want it to be easy, medium, or hard. But then the AI can assess how good you are and can adjust it to get you into that sweet spot of, I'm a really, really good player, but I want it to be relaxed right now. So it would be much more difficult for you than it would be for other people, even though it's quote-unquote relaxed. And you can adjust things. Instead of adjusting how strong or, you know, how powerful you are, you can adjust things like how tactically sophisticated is the enemy, which is, and you can just start to play around with different dials that you never had control over again, or control over before. And the reason why that's significant is because that's all about that learning curve. Like, humans, people like to learn. We enjoy the process of being at the edge of a challenge and succeeding. And if you can fine tune it so that no matter who's playing, they can always be on the cusp of defeat, but systematically succeeding, for whatever that means for them, you can create games that are really, 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 really compelling and addicting. I can imagine why that's something that people are looking into and getting excited about.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's see here. Video gaming is addicting. Apparently, video games are more addicting than Facebook.
That's not shocking.
Yeah, I believe it. As we know, they can improve real-world performance, which is cool. And therefore, gamification is getting into all the different apps, you know, even Starbucks. Right? I know our mom, she gets into that. She's like, oh, I got to collect my stars for the day. And apparently, MyFitnessPal has it. I missed that part of the game, I guess. They say Nest has it too. Whatever. Another Samsung ad. Data created per year is up 10%. And you look at this chart, and it's clearly exponential, which also makes sense. Esports is exploding in popularity. I haven't gotten into esports. Have you?
No, but. No.
Apparently, it's up 40% year over year. 43 million people watched League of Legends finals.
I get why people are into it. I will say that. I just, it's not, yeah. I don't really watch a lot of TV. Taking time to watch the Warriors, like they're watching the entire game for the finals for the NBA. This is like the sports team that this is the most I've ever been into a sports team. And so me taking an entire 3 hours a couple of times a week to watch a game is a huge deal. So taking the time to watch video games is just, it's just not going to happen. I'm just not into it enough.
What do you think is the number one reason that people cut their cable cord?
Because it's stupid. It's inconvenient. It's expensive. And it's just not that entertaining.
80% of the people do it because it's too expensive. 48% do it because they use an internet streaming service. 27% just use an antenna. 19% like to binge watch. 13% dropped it because they were moving. And then 11% bulk of viewing is streaming service, original content. Another Samsung ad. And recorded music revenue is finally growing thanks to streaming. After a 16-year decline, it went up a little bit.
You know?
And it really is because of, they show like physical sales, which are pretty much nothing now, download and synchronization, which is, it's less now, and then it's really that subscription and streaming is clearly where we're headed. It's pretty interesting. That'll be chart 33, by the way, when you go look it up later. Netflix is slowly dragging down television. Surprise, surprise. If you're spending time on Netflix, you're not spending it on television. That is a zero-sum game.
Yeah, that's true.
I thought this was interesting, actually. YouTube is losing mobile video share as Facebook and Snap grow.
Huh.
Yeah, right? I'm still number one and still by a lot, but Facebook, Instagram, Snap, and Netflix to some degree are all up. Even iTunes. Apparently Google Cloud. I don't know what that is. But YouTube's fallen.
Interesting. It's really interesting.
Let's see here. Another Samsung ad.
Except it makes...
Enterprise is starting... What?
They say, except it does make sense, because, I mean, how you, because of how people use YouTube. If you have a particular channel or show you like to watch, well, then you'll go to wherever it is. If it's YouTube, you'll stay on YouTube. But for just the casual, I've discovered a video, I'll just watch it wherever I discovered it. I don't go to YouTube to watch this particular funny video. If it's on Facebook, and I'm on Facebook, that's where I'll watch the video. So, that makes sense why... they're able to pull it away. In order to really beat YouTube, you're going to have to build up the community of channels and content creators. But just for casual, that sort of casual stuff, it would be easy to pull away from YouTube.
Fair enough. Let's see here. Malicious attachments and spam has skyrocketed, apparently. It used to be just annoying, but now they're actually more malicious than ever before. Mm. And then let's see here. And then I think the rest of these are all about China, where it used to be that healthcare and information technology. How do I read this? Used to be healthcare and consumer staples were the number one creators of wealth in China. And now it's information technology, then healthcare, then other stuff. It's a lot more spread out now. China has hit 700 million mobile users.
Wow.
That's a lot. That's why companies care. Another Samsung ad. Mobile devices. Mobile drives Chinese media consumption. And China pays for live streaming. They also lead on-demand transport as bike sharing skyrockets. They got another Samsung ad. Let's see here. News feeds drive 30% Chinese ad revenue growth. Shocker, who cares? Let's see here. Another Samsung ad. Tech is improving healthcare. Surprise, surprise. I think.
Right, yeah.
It's working. maybe that's the good news. And we're entering the age of genomics, apparently. So the time and cost of sequencing human genome has dropped faster than Moore's Law.
That's amazing. It makes sense because it's one of those... punctuated equilibrium thing where the technology has been moving along, and it's only because they're benefiting from years of tech development,
right?
And they haven't caught up to the current state of the art for tech, which is why they're able to move faster than Moore's Law, which is what happened to things like drones. One of the reasons why drones have moved so quickly is because they're leveraging other technologies that had been in development for a decade.
Yeah, like we've talked about, drones are just flying computers.
Yeah, well, and particularly, they're flying cell phones.
And they weren't, and now all of a sudden they are.
Exactly. So,
yeah. All right, rounding out the end here. Surprise, surprise, internet companies rule the public markets.
Yes.
Let's see, the top five by market cap are all tech. Apple, Alphabet, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, then Berkshire Hathaway. That's crazy. Then Exxon, Johnson & Johnson, Tencent, and Alibaba. Crazy.
Alibaba.
Let's see here. Da-da-da-da. Tech giants continue to expand and converge. We know that. Another ad for Samsung. More tech companies are staying private.
That's interesting.
That's interesting. Or they do a blockbuster IPO. That seems to be a big trend. And acquisitions are popular lately. They make a point here that immigrants create jobs. 60% of... Okay, I'll just read the whole sentence. Of the most highly valued tech companies in the U.S., 60% were founded by first or second generation Americans and created 1.5 million jobs.
Cool. It's not enough to...
That's it.
Not enough to... help the rest of the economy, but that's automation for you.
Yeah.
There's been some really...
So, anyways.
Yeah.
Those are the good... All the other ones? Boring.
Yeah, I like it.
So we'll link to this article that has all the good slides. If you want to look at it yourselves.
Yeah, good, it's interesting stuff, man.
That's your state of the internet.
Mary Meeker. Yeah, it's... Yeah,
Meeker Mary.
You're right, man. You gotta... got to slim it down a bit.
Doesn't she?
Yeah. But cool. So, yeah. Man, oh man.
Just let that sink in.
I know.
It's your annual update.
Trying to come up with a good segue, and it's just not happening, so I'll just dive into it.
Even further out into the future.
Well, or just what's going on today. So last week we talked about AlphaGo beating, whipping on the world's best Go player, human Go player, since now the world's best Go player is AlphaGo. And there was a follow-up article there were a couple of follow-up articles about it. I'm linking to the one by The Verge because I thought it was the best. And there's just stuff going on with AI right now. It's all sort of like, there's larger patterns that are going on. And, I keep making the argument that, in all of human history, automation has destroyed a few jobs, but has created more jobs. And so we've always said that, automation is good on the whole because, it leads to more jobs. It's good for the economy. But I've asked the question of, is it possible to have automation not do that to some degree? And is it possible that you can automate the process of automating things in such a way that you can automate things, jobs faster than you can come up with new jobs, which would be a real problem. And it's interesting that, like, this week, administration announces that it's getting out of the Paris Accords. And
I just had an article about that.
And actually, one of the fascinating parts to me about that whole conversation, because there's all sorts of science and politics around that, and I don't really want to get into it because it's just, I hate people yelling at each other, and I'll say something and you'll think I'm dumb and then you'll respond and I'll think you're dumb, and it's just, but so I don't want to talk about that in particular, but what I do think is really interesting is that a lot of this is being spurred by the coal industry and coal jobs not, being driven out of America, and the Paris Accords are sort of the thing that a lot of people who support the coal industry were pointing to as the quintessential example of the Obama administration not caring about, coal miners. And because why would you do that? Why would you do something that hurt that entire industry so much? And that's why Trump wants to get out of the Paris Accords, is to help people like coal miners. And we've seen in the last quarter, coal has been manufacturing, producing more coal than they ever have. Like, they're at all-time highs for coal production, but they're also still shrinking in employment. And the explanation is, unsurprisingly, automation. And how, the point being that those jobs are going away. It doesn't matter how much coal we produce at this point. That industry, coal miners, aren't going to continue to be coal miners, period. Like, that's just how it's going to be, unless you outlaw automation, and which, there will be people who will advocate for that, I guarantee it, if they're not already advocating for it. But the AlphaGo success last week sort of points to this impending doom. Because there's a couple of challenges that come with developing an artificial intelligence. I talk about this a lot, but I always think it's worth kind of getting into what it is that machine learning is, and simple analogies for them, I think. I like to describe machine learning as their pattern-finding machines, really, really complicated ones. They can find, they look for patterns in information and then simplify it into what this pattern is. So, for example, it's easy for people to identify what a dog is because there's a certain, you meet a new dog, you don't wonder what that thing is. It fits a pattern of what a dog looks like and you go, oh, that's a dog. And machine learning is basically you feed it thousands of images of dogs, you identify where the dog is, and this computer program will figure out that pattern and can return the answer of, oh, that's a dog.
Got it.
And there are two key points to that process. Number one, it requires a tremendous amount of what they call bootstrapping, which is literally you have to help it by giving it a lot of pre-processed information. You can say, hey, this is the problem that, you know, we want you to identify dogs. Here's thousands of pictures of dogs. And they're already identified as dogs. So it makes it very easy for the machine to sort of go through that and figure out, oh, okay, I can figure out what the characteristics of a dog are. And what's really interesting with more sophisticated neural networks and convolutional neural networks in particular is that you can just feed it pictures of dogs without identifying where the dog is in the picture. And if you feed it enough pictures, it will actually start to differentiate dogs from an entire scene. So it's just a much more complicated pattern finding machine. Well, one of the difficulties is if you show it thousands of pictures of dogs, but you always withhold pugs from that data set, what you end up with which is effectively a knowledge gap, which is it doesn't really know what a pug looks like. And so if you show it a picture of a pug, it might identify it as a dog. It will probably identify it as an animal. It definitely won't identify it as a pug. And if it also can identify cats, it might identify a pug as a cat because it has a very distinct facial structure compared to other dogs. And so those are the two things that you really struggle with in artificial intelligence learning. And AlphaGo had an interesting strategy for how they taught it, because they started by bootstrapping it with millions of games and millions of moves, so it's learned from human players. And then they had it start playing against itself. And this creates a unique optimization problem where it would learn from itself. It would get better as it was playing itself. But if there was a previous knowledge gap, if there was some sort of play that it didn't really know, it wouldn't even self-identify that. It had a very difficult time doing that. And so it would optimize to other different things. You can think of it as like climbing a mountain. It's trying to climb a mountain. And every time it would take a step forward, if it went up, it'd go, okay, so it'd keep moving forward. If it went down, it would say, all right, we've got to turn a different direction. Well, if there's two peaks, how do you find both peaks? And that's the knowledge gap problem. How do you find the other peak? And AlphaGo Master, the AI that beat the world's best human player, they had a couple of unique strategies to deal with those problems. And that's actually what made this thing so much better. Because if you remember the last time AlphaGo played against a human, it actually lost one of the games. And what occurred was the player identified one of those knowledge gaps and exploited it to beat AlphaGo. And they knew that if they played a better human player, and they'd get wrecked, because it would look at those moves and say, oh, I can exploit that every time. They would identify the weaknesses of the player. So in order to beat the world's best player, they basically had to say it needs to self-identify its own weaknesses and build those up. So they came up with a bunch of different strategies. And one of the cool parts about that is that it actually went so far as to say, not only can it, because it can identify its own weakness, that means that we need fewer and fewer data sets for bootstrapping. And one of the things they're talking about right now is they're actually training a version of AlphaGo without bootstrapping it at all. They're teaching it the rules of the game. Not even really teaching it the rules of the game. They're just letting it play against itself using this new strategy and seeing if, without any data, it can figure out how to become, if it can be AlphaGo Master or be as good as AlphaGo Master, because they've already succeeded at solving the problem. And what they're talking about is how, like, this problem generalizes is what's really cool about it. This is something that they're like, this strategy for developing AIs and having them learn can be applied to many other fields. And in Google internally, they've let AlphaGo develop their air conditioning systems for their servers, their data centers.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, and what's really cool is what they were finding is they would, like, depending on how many servers you have on, it produces a certain amount of heat, and an AC unit can extract a certain amount of heat. So what they would do is they'd turn on an AC unit, and then once enough servers came on where one air conditioning unit couldn't handle it, they'd turn on another AC unit. And so the AC units would just, they turn them on as data centers went up. And what their AI figured out was that it was actually hugely wasteful, because it turns out turning on an AC unit is the most costly process that you can do. Turning one up isn't, though. And so what they said, what they actually ended up doing is they turn on all of their AC units and just turn them to the lowest setting. And then as they need more capacity for getting rid of heat, they can balance amongst a bunch of different AC units to figure out, okay, what's the actual best way to dissipate the heat that we have. This is done using an AI that is effectively the same structure as AlphaGo, but just trained to a different problem set. It's trying to beat a different game. And they're pointing out that this is something that they're going to be able to apply to diagnostics research, all sorts of medical fields, and it's just going to keep going, growing and growing and growing. So these more and more complicated problems where it can actually, these AIs can become better at solving this particular problem than a person, and it needs a lot less data. So you can set them loose on problems that are new problems, or have a very limited data set, which to this point is not something AIs have been able to handle. They're really only able to handle problems that have enormous data sets, which is the other interesting part about that is that humans are very good at learning patterns with smaller data sets and figuring out the rules of something and can apply it and practice it with ourselves. It's like learning math. You don't need to be given a million math problems. You can actually learn math on your own by developing your own problems and solving them yourself. So this has been like, it turns out that AlphaGo, you know, we talked about last week how it's a solved problem because it's a certain class of problem that's really exciting. Yeah, it turns out it's even a bigger deal I was mentioning that to last week for the sorts of problems it can solve. But that's not the only things where the only success of AI. There's some real world stuff that like is actually being applied. IBM been advertising their junk like crazy during the NBA playoffs. Specifically, their Watson. Watson got world fame for its natural language processing that it was able to beat Ken Jenner's at a
Jennings.
Ken Jennings at what's it called?
Jeopardy.
Yeah, Jeopardy. And which is pretty cool. But they've expanded Watson to be able to do different things. Specifically, they're looking at oncology. So not just diagnosing cancer, but coming up with different treatments and stuff. And what's really cool is a handful of studies being presented at ASCO. Researchers show that Watson for oncology is pretty dang good at recommending treatments for a variety of different cancers. From research done in India, Watson's treatment recommendations were in agreement with those of physicians 96% of the time for lung cancer, 93% of the time for rectal cancer, and 81% of the time for colon cancer. There were comparable rates of agreement for colorectal, lung, and breast and gastric cancer treatments in a tie-based study. Additionally, Watson was able to screen breast and lung cancer patients for clinical trial eligibility 78% faster than a human, reducing screen from 110 minutes down to just 24. What I thought was interesting about this is they're not actually trying to prove that it's necessarily better at it than doctors, but that it's as good as Doctors, which is cool because what it means ultimately is you need fewer doctors. One doctor can do more. One doctor who learns how to communicate with Watson can now trust Watson because it has a proven track record of doing a good enough job. So a single oncologist can now manage more and more patients, which in countries and regions where you got third world conditions, that's a huge deal. And in places like America where you have profit goals, that's a huge deal because oncology doctors are really expensive and Watson is less expensive. Yes. So this is, it's one of those things where it's not trying to say it's curing everybody of cancer. What it's trying to say is this is now a tool that just offloads one part of a doctor's work and makes it so that one doctor can handle more patients. And yeah, so I'll have to figure out new stuff to do. And they're focusing on cancer because cancer is a ridiculously difficult problem. But one of the advantages of solving a difficult problem is that it makes solving simpler problems even easier. So you can expect this to start diagnosing and treating things that are simpler diseases to deal with in relatively short order, I suspect. And the fact that IBM is having huge success with this and Google has, in combination with their sister company, Verily Life Sciences, yeah, they're going to get in this big too. And then the other one is back to Google. They're a big fan of using the machine learning they have for real world applications. And one of the new places that you can do that is they're using machine learning to help you visualize your data. So Google Sheets is Google's not quite as good version of Excel.
Yep.
But they're trying to give it stuff that you can't get with Excel, which is pretty cool. So specifically, one of the features that you can do now is you can ask it to, hey, Google, can you make a graph for this data? So you got a bunch of columns, you want a graph. You can just ask it, and it will produce a graph with that data. There have been similar features that you could just like, that lets you automatically visualize all the data in a sheet, but this is now letting you actually talk to it and specify what data you want compared to other data, which is pretty cool that we're at the point where this sort of a structure is. I mean, it's boiling down to what I would consider less important problems. This isn't, it's... You're starting to see it be featured, become a feature in ways that aren't super critical to, curing cancer or, other really difficult problems like that. You're watching it get filtered down into, it's just the more consumer grade problems. Big part of that is Google's new TPU stuff, their tensor processing units. That's another point that I forgot to bring up with AlphaGo. They said that it's a much more sophisticated version of AlphaGo, but it runs on a single second gen tensor processing unit machine in Google Cloud, whereas the previous version used 50 TPUs at once. You shouldn't think of this as running on compute power that's beyond the access of normal people. The special thing about it is the algorithm that's being used as opposed to the amount of compute. So basically saying, the reason why this works is because the algorithms are getting better. They're more efficient. They can run just as fast on less powerful equipment, which is huge because it makes it financially viable. So we're all in trouble. They're taking our jobs. Eventually they're going to kill us all and replace us with the next step in evolution, silicon-based life. But
I had a thought. I had an article, but apparently I don't.
I hate that.
That it was Bill Gates wrote a review of a book that he had read that was talking about the future of automation, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this weird, like, what happens when all our jobs are taken kind of book. And this guy takes a genuine, like, try to look forward at it and try to evaluate it. And Gates was like, you know, it's one of the most measured ones I've seen and blah, blah, blah. I thought it was good. But the question was, or the statement, I guess, was humans are driven by a purpose, by having to do something. And if you take away our job, we no longer have a purpose that's connected to a job. Do we then look for other things to work on? Or do we go into a, you know, never-ending depression? And which Gates has been, he's been very emphatic about saying, look, his, and I think I heard this on a talk show too, where it was like, historically, jobs being taken away have led to even more jobs being created.
Right.
It's asymmetrical. I know, I get it. There's systematic unemployment that happens, but all in all, it creates more variety. However, that's before AI and all this other stuff that we've figured out. And the question is this different than, say, the cotton gin?
Yes.
Or
that is the question.
Is it not? Because now the machine can run the machine, essentially.
Right.
I don't actually think we're to that point yet where the machine runs the machine.
No.
But, like, that's the mythical future we're all concerned about. Yeah. And the question is, well, what happens when that happens? And, you know, and Gates was, he was trying to address this idea of, he goes, look, I'm an optimist. I think it's going to be all right. And he's like, we will find a purpose. And it came into, like, he was talking about what are different constructs that define how we work. You know, we create rules based on morality and our jobs and what our goals are. And he's like, and those things will change, especially our goals, and therefore laws will change. But at the end of the day, he was like, look, as long as these things are in service to humans, we'll be okay. All right.
Yes, that does.
Maslow,
I know. Gotcha. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's a fascinating problem. You know, it's one of those things where I completely agree with him. I don't think it's a bad thing. I'm not a pessimist on this sort of stuff at all. I tend to think that, you know, I'm glad that people understand the idea of there can be a type of automation that is different than past automation, and not all automation is going to result in the same progress. And it's just worth considering. It's worth understanding that we might be, you know, it's entirely possible that there's going to be another roadblock that we don't understand. I mean, back in the 60s, they thought that that's where we were with AI. Like, this isn't the first time we've come to this rodeo.
Right.
Where we've been at the cusp of AI destroying everything and taking all your jobs and completely taking over. And this is just arguably one type of AI that is very successful. And it might have its own roadblock that we'll find in, you know, the next 3 or 4 years or even 20 years that just makes it impossible to kind of get to that level that I'm talking about. There might be a fundamental issue that we don't understand yet that really prevents it from taking over the markets. And yeah, there will be a lot of types of jobs that will be automated, but there literally are certain things that it can't ever do. That's possible. And then all of those jobs will still be done by people. And like you said, it will be asymmetric. That's possible. At the same time, this one's really promising to not have that issue, especially because it works so similarly to its, the entire concept of it is modeled after how neurons work. It's designed to be able to replicate what brains do and how they do it. And there are real problems with it, but there are with actually modeling a brain, but there are also real advantages. And I still come back to, I think the biggest issue we're going to run into is everybody keeps thinking, well, you'll never get something as smart as a human. And I keep saying, yeah, that's not when the problem starts. Problem starts long before that. And the nice part is Bill Gates' take on it, which is as long as they're in service of humans, we'll be fine. Well, if we never really get to a general purpose AI, something that's as smart as a human is, then and able to learn anything effectively, as if we never get there, yeah, we'll be sitting pretty cool. I mean, it'll be a rough transitional period, but it will be good for humanity. The real issue will be when we get to something that can learn anything, become self-aware. Is actually what's scarier than something that's self-aware is, and to me, is something that's not self-aware but is super intelligent, because that can be very difficult to control. And the analogy that I come up with is, you know, we're doing all sorts of complicated calculations when we catch a ball that somebody throws to us, and yet we recognize it as intuition. And a superintelligence that can design spacecrafts using the same sort of intuition that we catch a ball that flies through the air with would be quite the reckoning. And when many of them are that smart, it gives you a lot of, and that's the direction we're going. You know, before we get something that's conscious, we'll get something that can do that. And I don't think that that's a real far and distant future. And for the record, I do think designing a spacecraft is as difficult a task as governing, which means that something that can operate a spacecraft can probably do government as well. And I don't know. I think we're gonna get some weird places real quick. And people aren't ready for it. I'm very excited that I'm alive for it, just because I think it'll be interesting. And I'll probably lose my job over it, but hey, at least I saw it coming. And I'd rather be right than happy. But
that's fair.
Yeah. So I read an interesting article this week, kind of changing speeds. Arm, the company that is kind of in charge, they design all the intellectual property for most of the chips that go into mobile phones. We're talking this week about the idea of China speed, which is what they coin it.
China speed.
And it's basically the speed at which China does stuff. And it's neck breaking. They are basically, they treat hardware the same way that Google and Facebook treats software. They move real fast and break stuff.
Huh.
And ARM is talking, it's interesting. Basically, the big thing that kind of spurred this idea for them was they were talking about how, you know, 10 years ago, they would release the IP for a new chipset, and then it could take 2 years for a product to hit the market with using that new IP. And they're like, nowadays it's like 8 months. And what's so crazy about that is that in order to do that, you actually have to design hardware before the chip is finished being designed. And you have to be testing it based on the premise that the chip will work the way you think it's going to work. Basically what's ended up happening is China is moving ridiculously fast, taking advantage of features and building these really cheap feature phones using the absolute latest technology. And they're able to do that because they have a culture based around move fast, break stuff in hardware. There's just a lot of money and emphasis on building companies that's what they do. They hit their prominence by innovating the newest tech super quickly and being out there before anybody else. There does end up being some pretty amazing disasters along the way, because companies will just fizzle out because they bet wrong. But there's something really interesting going on in China as a consequence. Now, obviously, the iPhone is pretty dominant in America, so we don't really get that. Neck break speed. But one of the things they talk about is in China, you get these, like, these names will become huge really quickly, like Xiaomi, and then a year and a half later you'll stop hearing about them at all, and it's because somebody else bet better on the next generation of the phone. And in China, there's just this huge emphasis from consumers to, we want something that does everything and does it at the cheapest from the consumer level. And so that's where everybody is. That's where all the production is going into. It's really cool.
It's crazy
to watch. Yeah. Yeah, and especially because there's stuff like ARM itself is promising a 50x improvement in AI performance for the next 3 to 5 years, which is likely to catalyze yet another round of upgrades. So there are things that ARM is producing. You know, we talked a couple weeks ago about how ARM released its first generation of image processor units that are supposed to make, because we've talked about how most cameras, a lot of phones use the same camera modules as Google's Pixel or Samsung's S8 or something that's on par with Google's or with Apple's camera. But they don't get the same image quality because it's all about the image processing units at this point. It makes a huge difference. Well, ARM released that to the wild a couple of months ago and said, this is our first generation of it. And normally a company, it would take them, somebody would have to take that IP, turn it into a silicon chip, manufacture the chips, test them out, then go into production. That production would then get delivered to a hardware company who is going to integrate it into their test equipment, into their prototypes. They test the prototypes, they build the prototypes, and then they go into manufacturing. That's just not going to happen. There are already companies that are bringing that new that new intellectual property into their prototypes for phones, just on the premise that chip will be here in short order. And everybody's just moving ahead at neck-break speed on this. And so you're going to see those sorts of integrations move really, really, really quickly. And it'll be interesting to watch Apple continue to try to stay ahead of the curve on that sort of stuff. But I think it'll be even more interesting to see Google try to stay keep their hardware ahead of the curve. It's crazy, man. You get a billion people together to sort of brute force these problems, you get some pretty amazing solutions. But yeah, it's fun to watch.
Yeah, that's insane. Huh. Well, speaking of changes, I don't know if you've noticed this, but in the last year or so, maps have been changing.
Yeah.
Specifically, Google Maps and, to a much lesser extent, Apple Maps.
Okay.
There was a cool breakdown by a guy named Justin O'Brien. O'Brieny. I'm thinking it's O'Brien, just spelled weird. And he does some comparisons between the changes in Google Maps and Apple Maps. Apparently, he did like this cartography comparison last June, like a year ago June.
All right.
And this guy has been taking screenshots every month for the last year.
Jeez.
Just to track the changes. Yeah, pretty intense. And he dives a lot into some of the things that Google Maps has done. And essentially he said they did something weird last summer where they announced that they were making a change to their map color palette. He was like, okay. And essentially they made everything lighter. And he was like, that's really weird. Why would you make everything a lot lighter? It's harder to read.
Yeah.
And he said, but then they started making even more changes this last year. And so one of the things that he says Google Maps has fundamentally changed from a street map to an interest map. He goes, and in order to do that, they had to lighten the map background so they could fill it in with different interests. And he says, and honestly, they started out with just, it was labels with white icons. And now, today, they're labels with different colored icons on a much lighter background now. And he was showing he shows a bunch of comparisons. It's long and fascinating. And it's like, and then there's things where it's like, the different roads now have different, textures and colors around them. Like one of the things he talked about was they used to have drop shadows for like water. It's like, that's all gone now. It's all flat, which is part of that's like the current design too. But then he zooms in on this one park in San Francisco.
Patricia's Park.
And what?
Patricia's Park. I can say the word.
Yes. And he says, not only did they have the paths wrong at the beginning of the year, but eventually they fixed it. And then it went from looking like a road to more of a walking path. And which that was interesting. And then the other thing that he talked about was just the labeling of where different businesses are, different interests. And he was saying that Google seemed to be a lot more consistent. And one of the places where Apple really struggled was where if there was a business that like shared the same building, he was like, Apple would rotate which business was displayed. Huh. He goes, whereas Google pretty consistently had all of them there. He was like, so Apple would have a lot of, looked like it had a lot more turnover. It was like, but they just couldn't decide which of these three businesses they wanted to put there. He did go on the note that a lot of the stuff that Google has now, like with the interest in the colors, he was like, Apple Maps had that from day one.
Right.
It's like, so in some ways playing catch up. But that was the other interesting thing is like, if you did a comparison of Apple Maps a year ago to today, he's like, I know that Apple said they made a bunch of changes and all this stuff from the ground up. He's like, I don't see it.
Yeah.
He's like, and being that both Apple and Google use San Francisco in their keynotes and as their examples, he would say that you would think that that would be the one that was the most polished and put together. He's like, and it just, for whatever reason, says they don't. Now, part of it is, he says, Google, obviously, they build all their own maps. They collect all their own data, whereas Apple buys the data from others. And like, because I guess Apple, they don't have the path right for that park. And he's like, yeah, and if you, they probably get this data from TomTom because they have the exact same wrong map.
Right, yeah.
And he's like, so that's most likely what it is. But I mean, like he does some super in-depth analysis of like comparing road corners.
Jeez.
To show. It's like, see, you can see his TomTom. Like, okay, I get it.
Yeah. I believe you actually. You could just stated it as fact.
But I think he does a pretty convincing job of proving, I think, what a lot of us feel, which is like Google Maps is better than Apple Maps. Just from a, yeah, from an interest standpoint, from a search for a specific thing. I know for me, like if I have an address, I'll put it in Apple Maps because I feel pretty good. Like it's going to be able to get me there. But if I am searching for a place, like place to eat or something, yeah, I go to Google Maps. Usually get the address and then throw it into Google Map or Apple Maps to get the turn by turn. A, it syncs with my watch. B, it uses less battery.
Yeah.
C, I'm a fanboy. What can I say?
Yeah.
But yeah, pretty interesting. It's hard to verbally describe it, but he has some really cool like moving GIFs that show the changes like every single month that they've made. And it's clear like Google is super active on their maps and constantly changing it and adding little improvements. I personally think it looks better than it used to. It's cleaner, and I think they agree as well.
Yeah.
And then he does a bunch of other ones where he's got like he'll show the transition of New York, and then he does London as well, and then also just San Francisco in general. It is a lot lighter and brighter, and the interests are definitely more obvious. And I've appreciated like Google even doing stuff where it's like, we will surface different interests that we think you care about, not just some standard set. So if you and I looked at the same map, we would actually see a different set of interests based on who it thinks we are and what we're interested in. And what we searched for recently.
Right. But cool.
Anyways, thought it was interesting.
Seems very confused.
Google Maps. Apparently it's better.
Pretty nice.
According to this guy.
So you're not going to be able to use Apple Maps on this next phone, but the guy who invented the Android phone, Andy Rubin, he had a big announcement this week that kind of took over for everybody. I'll be honest, it seemed kind of boring. He announced a new piece of hardware, which Yeah, it's called the Essential Phone. Maybe there's turns out there's copyright problems or
oh really?
Brand. It's not a what's it called? Trademark issues. Yeah, there's another company that makes like mobile electronics that has that brand name already, and they tried to buy it from them, and the company said no. They decided to call it that anyway. So that'll be a fun.
You don't do I know. That, dude. That's messed up.
Yeah, but the idea of it is,
if you asked and the company said no, you're essentially tacitly admitting that they have the right to it.
Right. It'll be fun to watch. But yeah, so the idea of this is that it's the essential Android. It's just the essentials. It's nothing that's not needed. It's not a bunch of garbage, which is really interesting. In
I can appreciate
the context
that.
Of the China speed and how that market is dominated by really cheap phones that do everything, that have every feature. And he's building an entire company around a phone that has just the essentials. I think that's about the only part of it that I think will be interesting to watch, because to me it seems like it's just another Android phone. and it doesn't have the weight of Samsung behind it. It doesn't have the purity of Google behind it. And it doesn't have a cool feature that sort of sets it apart as this really, you know, unique device. It has a couple of things that seem fine. It's got this magnetic pin thing that kind of allow it to be more of a modular phone. So you can, like, they have an example where you can snap a 360 camera onto it and turn your phone into a 360 camera.
Yeah. That sounds cool.
It does sound cool. I do not understand why they have this, like, this weird interface instead of, like, a USB-C plug, which is what everybody else would do. It reminds me of, like, the bump to share your contact information. And everybody was like, oh, why doesn't Apple do this? And you'd always be like, because you actually have to physically touch them. I just text people anything I want to share. It's easier. It works everywhere. I don't have to get up and bump phones with this person. A weirdo. And I just look at this and I'm like, I look at the phone and I'm like, I don't see it. I see the marketing behind it. I see the idea of we're going to get just the essentials. But I think one of the biggest deficits that Google's Pixel phone has right now is that it doesn't have any like super special features other than an amazing camera, particularly their image processing stuff that they're doing. But that's really the big selling point, is that it's pure Android with a really great camera. And Samsung, it's, you know,
that's not the worst feature to have.
No, it's a great feature, but Andy Rubin's phones don't have that feature. They have just an okay phone. And, you know, as gotcha. Far as in their camera, unless you attach a 360 camera. So I don't know. It seems fine. And they also have this like weird, they want like an edge-to-edge screen, but they didn't know, it's like they didn't know what to do with the front-facing camera. So there's this weird bump in the middle of the screen. And they were talking about how, like, no, this totally makes sense, because most of the time when you're using your phone, that area at the top of the screen is, there's not really anything there. Maybe there's, like, if you look at your iPhone, the very top of the screen has the time. And they were like, but with the Android phone, that area isn't used. So they're like, so that's just wasted space.
How do you tell the time on an Android
phone? I don't know. You look at your watch. I don't know. But it's like, they were like, you can just space things to the side. And The Verge, who had like exclusive like meetings with Andy, were very praiseworthy of this innovation. And TechCrunch, who was re-reporting what The Verge was reporting, were like, this is the dumbest thing ever. Why would you do that? It's like, they're like, what if I'm watching a movie or I have a full screen video game? I'm just going to have a camera right there on the screen? It's actually
they do the bars.
Exactly. Yeah. I know. And they're like, so what's the point of this? What are you trying to get over on it? Just either figure out what to do with that camera hole or put a bezel there. Like, that's what Samsung does. That's what Apple's going to do. That's what everybody does. Why are you making this so ugly? This was pretty funny.
I think it looks cool.
I think it looks fine. I just kind of tend to agree that it seems like a pointless innovation. I don't get... It's Andy Rubin, so people are giving it the time of day, I feel like. But I think once this thing finally hits, it's just going to land with a dud. I don't suspect that this will get a lot of legs. And because it just doesn't seem like the sort of thing that... Doesn't feel like a game changer to me, James. Just doesn't.
I'm kind of like, if Google can't make inroads with a Pixel...
Right.
What chance does he have?
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, that's my thought. Because it isn't... There is nothing distinctive about it.
Now...
Like you were talking about. I mean, the accessories thing, maybe.
If his argument is, look, we don't really care. Like, I just... The phone that I wanted didn't exist. And I had the money to start a company that would make the phone that I want. And that's good enough for me. I don't have to... I'm not trying to take down Samsung. If that's his argument, he just wants to make enough money so that he can continue to have the phone he wants and that's not offered currently, then that's a cool project, actually. Like, I respect it. And you can do some really innovative and forward-thinking looking things and actually lead the market in a lot of ways by testing out innovations that Samsung's not going to try or whatever. But it's not going to be anything more than that. If that's all they want it to be, cool. I'm excited for you guys. I'm all for rooting for you. But they don't come across as that's what they want it to be. They come across as though it's like, no, this is the future. We've got it sorted.
Well, you have to sell it that way. Anything short of that, you're dead.
Yeah, well, I guess. I don't know. I come back. Elon Musk is always...
I think if I was in the Android market, honestly, I probably wouldn't get a Samsung. I'd look heavily at the Pixel, and then this one I'd take a look at it, and I'd probably choose a Pixel. Is probably
what I want to get the Zenfone AR
because I think Pixel has just as much of a simplicity about it.
Yeah, my goal is to get the.
And it's made by Google. It's the same reason why I like Microsoft Surface, yeah. Right? It's just it seems simple, has that essence to it. I like that.
Yeah, I hear you. Like I said, I want the Zenfone AR, which is Asus is making the phone, and it's got all the cool features. It's got Tango. It's got Daydream. It's got a really beastly processor. You know, it's got all the cool future facing innovations that I want, and as opposed to I don't know, it's just. This 360 camera just doesn't do it for me, guys. I got one more story I want to talk about.
Okay.
Google announced this week they're going to release an ad blocker built into Chrome, which everybody was kind of tripping about. And
what's up with that?
They're describing it as an ad filter, not quite an ad blocker.
What's the difference?
Yeah, and the idea is they are as frustrated by bad ads as we are, turns out. And they're like, look, if we build this into every version of Chrome and we're very clear on what's considered a bad ad and what's considered an okay ad, then everybody will be forced to conform to those definitions. And
that feels like some sort of antitrust
really
waiting to happen.
Really does, doesn't it?
I mean, I'm on board.
I know, me too.
But...
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem like that's going to end.
You know, and I'll say this, you know, one of the reasons why I don't turn off the ads on, I don't have an ad blocker on my phone, is because there are a couple of sites that have obnoxious ads that jump in the way or whatever, but for the most part, they're not super obtrusive. Whereas I find that the ads on just normal desktops are horrible, even when they're not intrusive. They're just like... I've talked about this before. One of the websites that I read is Mac Daily News, and I have an ad blocker on them, even though they fight really hard to get you to turn off your ad blocker. And I'm like, you know, honestly, since I read your articles multiple times a week, I've on multiple occasions it turned off the ad blocker at their request for like 10 minutes and been like, I can't do this. Like, you straight up have half-naked girls like being advertised on your webpage. I'm at work. I just can't do this. Like, sorry, MBN.
Yeah.
They're a particularly bad version of the.
I like give the at work caveat, by the way.
What?
But I just like that you give the at work caveat.
Well, I mean, frankly, this is what I do at work. I mean, I don't.
Well, I was just thinking, if I was at home, it'd be fine. That was all.
I hear you. Like, no, yeah, I. Hmm. Yeah, when I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying.
Moral statement.
I hear what you're saying, and my the reason why I said it the way I did is because this is how I waste time at work. I don't want to waste time, so I don't read my daily news. but
good point. That's a different issue.
Exactly. I don't know. I just, And so I think it'll be really interesting.
Yeah, what do you do when you want to support them, but you also don't want to support that?
Right.
I mean, the right answer would be don't visit the site.
Yeah.
And that's how you would vote, essentially. Yeah. But Adblocker also seems like a good compromise.
Exactly. and so I'm excited because I think what this will do is, you know, it'll enforce community standards is effectively what it will do. And I will be more likely to turn off.
Who gets to make the laws? Google does?
That's actually the biggest complaint about it is that now Google becomes the enforcer of community standards. But
what about the open web?
I know. Well,
don't use Chrome.
Exactly.
Opera.
Exactly.
It's based on the same engine.
That's what they tell me.
Take a word for it because I'm not down
with it. It'll be interesting. And they've just announced that they're going to do it. So they're giving websites like a year to kind of.
This isn't news. Okay.
Yeah, it's not happening super soon. It's just.
That's forever.
It is, basically.
Will the web still be around in a year? I feel.
Probably not at the rate we're moving.
There's a chance it won't be. I mean, we're already spending, 30% of our time on mobile? But.
Yeah. I'm hearing you.
Crazy. Just a real quick update before we call it. Uber fired Anthony Lewandowski this week. Oh, man. So this is an interesting... it's not a curveball. It's not really an unexpected event because so far he has decided to not play along. And he was the guy who decided to take the fifth so he wouldn't incriminate himself, which, you know, just right out the gate, you're like, really?
Yeah, right.
And so Uber did like the only thing they could do, which was say, we asked him to show his stuff. He's not showing his stuff. He's not in compliance. So we have to fire him because anything short of that, they'd essentially be saying they'd be condoning his actions. Right. So they kind of had to do it. But now what's interesting about this is he's no longer part of Uber. He's his own individual. There's a possibility that he strikes a deal with Google. Just say, I'll tell you what I'm doing.
Jeez. Just
let me off the hook.
Right.
And we'll go after Uber.
That's exciting.
That could happen.
That is really exciting.
Yeah. Especially with potential criminal charges on the line for espionage and theft. Like, this is interesting.
Yeah.
I've got to imagine like the Waymo lawyers are just being like, this is too good. We have so many good.
This is awesome. Yeah.
But the idea would be that from Uber's standpoint, they can in some way say, we didn't know what he was doing. We were genuinely doing our own innovation. What he was contributing, we thought was original work.
Right.
Like that would be their defense.
Right.
Unless he says otherwise. So, I don't know. It could potentially fizzle out. Somebody's getting in trouble.
Right.
Is what it comes down to. What's also fun, and this is like just desserts, if you will, is so Anthony sold Otto to Uber for like $700 million, some ridiculous amount of money.
And Otto is his self-driving...
It was a self-driving truck.
Yeah, semis.
Semis, which had been in existence for like, 4 months?
Yeah.
And most of that was bought, like almost all of it, like what was it like of the 700,000, like 695 million of it was through stock and equity, which vests after a 2-year period and him hitting certain deliverables. He's been with the company less than a year, gets nothing.
Wow.
I'm sure he has some sort of cash compensation, so he's going to be fine. He's probably a millionaire. So
yeah.
Don't be too worried about it.
But still.
But, yeah, missing out on the big payday.
Right.
So, you know, in the end, I think I'm okay. You know, I feel like for him, justice was served.
Yeah. Feels good.
Yeah. We'll see if he lands somewhere else. Or not. I hope not. You know, I hope that all the other companies are like, dude, don't touch me. You know, that'd be really nice.
Yeah, that would be nice.
That's probably not true. You know, it's going to be like Ford or some GM's going to be like, we'll take you. you have to give up your computer.
Right, yeah.
It's just, you know, and maybe they're cool with it, right? Because like, hey, he's been fully scrubbed, so we're all good now. I could see that kind of logic.
Yeah.
I mean, you see ball clubs do that all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it's kind of different in sports now. I feel like executives...
But it's still kind of like, the attitude's there.
I think he's going to have to go back to creating his own... I think what he'll have to do is start his own company again and hopefully get bought and gets his next move. It's got to be... Because you're like you said, he's too corrosive. He's not gonna get hired again.
I don't. Well, yeah, we'll see. I would not be surprised, but yeah. I don't know. And you want to finish it up with the last comment there?
Sure. What do I do? I close it.
Waymo, self-driving.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So this is Waymo. Just sort of. To round out this last thought of Waymo's announced that they are starting to test doing their own trucking automation stuff, which a lot of companies were like, oh, you know, this is one area that Google is way behind everybody else. They haven't even tried something on the road. And you're like, yeah, but it's the same technology that they're the by far leader. So I feel. Like,
yeah.
This isn't going to be that much of a stretch for them. I feel like
a vehicle's a vehicle when it comes to driving.
They're going
to
make up a lot of lost ground real quickly by just turning it on. I don't know. It's cool.
Some of the mechanics, yes, it has to learn it, but
big deal. It's got a few more gears, but that's about it. So.
Well, you know, turning radiuses and things are more important. But
you know that...
I also have a feeling they generalize
Exactly. I was going to say, they've taken a lot of time over the years to they knew that eventually this was a problem they were going to try to solve. So they took that into account as they were solving the last problem. And this isn't like, oh my gosh, it's completely different. How are you going to catch up to everybody else? Like, no, they'll do it at neck-breaking speed. They'll be ahead in moments. Don't worry about it. Chill out. So it's cool stuff.
It is cool stuff. I like it. All right, next week, Apple.
Hey, get ready.
Literally, by the time we publish this, they will have already. No, we'll publish it before they're
out. Yes, we'll make it.
We'll be in by a couple hours. But that's all we're going to talk about next week. So, you know, if you're not into that, sorry. Alrighty, but thanks for joining us this week. That was good, man.
Yeah,
I liked it. Little internet trends, some China speed, talking about some maps, Pokemon Go, essentially a phone. I love it. So thanks for listening. Don't forget, you can check out all the show notes with all the links at furloughbros.com. that is episode 297. You can also get them sent directly to you via email on that same page. And finally, this podcast is supported by listeners just like you. If you would also like to contribute, we have 4 different levels in which you can do that. So just furloughbros.com. Check it all out. Again, episode 297. So, okay, I can do this. On that note, my name is James Furlough. And my wonderful brother is Matthew Furlough. And we will talk next time. We'll be right back.
Yeah.